I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. They'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. K2 KEY. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick make an attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and sometimes the fine details of all of that. We claim this is the new improved ham radio TechNet, in which during the first hour we try to briefly cover everyone who signs in with a question or a comment, try to get to them all. When it comes to the more dense material, that takes place after the first hour. At the end of the first hour, Mel goes to his mailbag for the newer hams who are getting their license, don't yet have access to be on the air and ask us questions directly. So by way of email, they mail him questions, and we try to handle those questions to help those guys out, guys and girls. Also, as I said, later on in the evening, we get into the deeper details. Lately, John, Wesley, I, and Glenn have been trying to understand what Mother Nature is saying at the molecular level, and a significant, let me drop, a significant on-the-air contact took place between that foursome, Wesley, Glenn, Dick, and John, in the wee hours of the morning on Wednesday, just at the beginning of the big snowstorm, in which we were discussing all kinds of things, cabbages and kings, but we got into one of the subjects we got into is what really takes place with FM modulation. And with their permission, at a little after 9 o'clock, I'd like to spend a little bit of time explaining something about FM modulation. It turns out that the majority of engineers only have a partial understanding. In turn, many of the ham radio operators who use FM modulation, like what you're listening to right now, only partially understand what it is. And so I'm going to give a little bit of an explanation of a little deeper explanation as to what it is. I know this is controversial because some people will say, why do I have to know this? In other words, I've got an FM transmitter, I turn it on, I plug it in, I apply 12 volts, I give it an antenna, I pick up the microphone, I talk, it works. Why do I have to know anything more than that? And for many people, that philosophy works. You can also say, I don't have to know how my automobile works. I turn the key, and the motor starts, I press on the accelerator pedal, it moves forward. I press on the brake pedal, it slows down. I turn the wheel, and the car turns right or left. I don't have to know any more than that. And as I said, there's many people with that philosophy, and it works for them. There's another group of people in both situations who want to know a little bit more about what's going on behind the front panel, so to speak. Knowledge is always powerful, in my opinion. Once you know how something works, once you've got a little bit more knowledge, even if it's something you didn't want to know, let me drop. With a little bit more knowledge, almost always you will eventually find some way of applying it. I've given the example of what happened when I first got introduced to microwave radio circuits. I first joined the Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Because of the way I was exposed to microwaves in the college I went to, I thought it's the most boring subject in the world. I'd never worked there. And I started working in the real world, met a man named Hank Keene, W2CTK, who showed me what microwaves are really like, and I said, wow. And that became my raison d'etre. He at the time was studying something called strip line, and it was a new kind of a transmission line. He was studying it and inventing some of the techniques on how it works. I started talking to him, found out how strip line works, and a year and a half later, out came the strip line amplifier tripler article in Ham Radio Magazine, February issue 1970. And 2 years later after that became the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier. So knowledge that you think you don't need, you'd be amazed how it gets applied. And so how does FM work? I'd like to describe a little bit of that. Let me drop. Now, at this time, we take sign-ins, people who have a question or a comment for the technical net. Please give me your call letters and your name, and we'll handle as many of those as we can with so-called brief answers to their questions or comments during the first hour. If there's not enough of those questions, we'll go to the mailbag a little bit early and start the FM discussion a little bit earlier. As I said, I hope John and Glenn and John and Wesley are available. I'm hoping that also Glenn will be available, so that we have the original cast of characters to reproduce what took place, which I think is significant. If you like understanding how things work, what took place last Wednesday night at the wee hours of the morning. So at this time, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2MB, Barry, and yes. Okay, sign in right now. K2RIW listening.
To me, it's Roy White, Joe. Yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. Anyone else? My goodness. Everybody, let's see now, is there a great big football game tonight? I don't think so. Is there a big snowstorm? I don't think so. Everybody's questions have all been answered already? I don't think so. Anyone else to sign into the tech desk? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Good evening.
K2KEY, Ed, with a comment.
K2KEY, good evening.
I've now recognized Ed. Was that K2KJE? Give me those call letters once again, Ed, please.
K2 Golf Juliet Echo, over.
Very fine, and I think you said you've got a comment. And we're going to hope we can talk you into a question also, Ed. Let's see, no, you're not the guy that signed in earlier. N2NYW, another Ed. He signed in 2 weeks ago, and we never got to him during the first hour. So if he signs in, he goes pretty high on the list, if you know what I mean. So far, with real questions or comments, we got Joe and Ed and Mel. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W2OSR, Bob, so that you don't feel quite so lonely out there, Dick.
Yeah, very fine, Bob. I was awfully saddened to hear that your mother, who on her 100th birthday passed away. And so both a happy and a sad situation. Happy that she lasted to 100 years. Not very many people do that. And sad, of course, that she had to pass on her birthday. We feel for you, Bob, and over you, Bob, for any further comments. W2OSR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, Dick, the phone call I got at 6:30 this morning was one I've been expecting for a good number of years, because despite the fact that she was still pretty well with it mentally, her health otherwise wasn't the greatest. We just didn't know exactly when this was going to happen. Obviously, we hoped it was going to be further into the future, but it was the luck of the draw, and she did make it to 100. God bless her.
Yeah, I think an extremely small percentage of the population makes it to 100 years of age, a centenarian, I guess we call them. And so, saddened, but, okay. Let's start off with Joe. Joe, looks like we've got not too many questions tonight, so we'll be able to spend quite a bit of time on your question if you so desire. Go right ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay, good evening, Dick. How you doing? I haven't checked in quite a while here. My question has to do with, not directly with amateur radio, but with radio in general, or I guess how it works. I'll just ask you my direct question. And I've always been fascinated by this. How does a radar guidance system work? You can either explain that simply or more, however you want to put it in detail.
Now, the FAA has a number of pieces of electronics that do a guidance function. You've got the VOR stations, the VHF omnidirectional ranging stations and direction finding stations. You've got the glide slope indicator at the runway. You've got other kinds of beacons that help guide an aircraft into the general area. You've got ground control approach. You've got surveillance radars, the ASR-7, among others, ASR-8. That's the main radar at each of these airports. You've got these control centers. So you better tell me which one of the many pieces of electronics that the FAA uses that you think you're referring to right now, if you know. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Don't forget Doppler.
There you go. But go ahead, Joe.
Okay. I wasn't specifically aiming the question at the FAA. It was more or less a generalized type of question as far as I understand, I guess, basically how a radar beam can go out, reflect off a target, and give you an answer back measured at time displacement between send to receive. I can understand that. Well, I guess I'm trying to understand is, how does it know which way the target goes? The target's moving, up from the target, up from the beam, to the left, to the right, down. How does it really know that? And I'm talking more of a, not primarily a ground-based station, but just any type of radar guidance system, even something that's airborne. Maybe you could just elaborate on that. How does it know which way the target is happening to be going? You can tell, of course, the distance, and I guess Doppler-shift can tell you other reasons. Is that, I guess, what the other part of it is, the Doppler-shift that measures which way it's going?
Yeah, interesting set of questions you've got there, Joe, and I think I know what you're asking for. And let me think now. I guess I've spent most of 40 years either directly or indirectly related to radar systems, radar-like systems, radar jammers, radar rotary joints, transmitters, receivers, pulse-forming networks, and so on, exciters, back-end processors. So, what is radar? RADAR is not a pure acronym. Radio Detecting and Ranging is what it intended to stand for. In World War II, that was a classified set of words. Many of the radars, if your eye worked at the radar frequency, you would see the signal coming out of the radar transmitting antenna as what they call a pencil beam. It's not quite a pencil. If you could see it with your eyes, it would look like a cucumber. So there's this cucumber-shaped antenna pattern transmitted by the radar antenna. Many of the radars, the antenna rotates once per 12 seconds, so it scans the whole 360 degrees in azimuth. In some cases, the cucumber-shaped antenna pattern is really a vertical blade, sort of like a beaver tail up on edge, if you know what I mean, where it covers many altitudes, but it's very sharp in azimuth. So that transmitted signal, let me drop. Is usually a couple of microseconds in duration, the strongest power output that the transmitter can put out, and then at the end of that couple of microseconds of very brief transmission, the pulse of energy goes out there, and the magic of radio is that if it sees pure constant impedance, in other words, if your coax cable didn't change in characteristic impedance one iota, the signal would continue to flow down the cable, and nothing would come back. And what happens inside of your coax cable, what happens inside of a waveguide, is extremely simple to similar to what happens in free space. In free space, you could say that radio wave is expecting to see nothing but 377 ohms of impedance. It's a fancy way of saying, well, what is the impedance of free space? And that in itself requires some explanation. Take my word for it. Any deviation in that impedance, whether it goes into a cloud that's more dense, whether it goes into an air pocket that's more dense, whether it hits a metallic object called aeroplane, whether it hits a dielectric object, aeroplane made out of wood and plastic. Let me drop. When that radio beam sees anything but a pure 377 ohms resistivity of pure free space, even if the signal started off from a satellite outside of the atmosphere of the Earth, and now the signal is entering the atmosphere. The atmosphere itself has a very slight difference in impedance, and so when any change in impedance of free space occurs, some percentage of the signal will reflect back at that interface front edge, so to speak, and a certain amount of it will propagate through. So when that radio beam from the radar transmitter hits anything in free space other than free space, some amount of it reflects back. When that signal reflects back and the same antenna is now looking in the same direction, but the transmitter can very rapidly flip back and forth between the transmit and receive mode, it measures the reception of that signal. The timing of that signal at roughly 6 microseconds per nautical mile going out, 12 microseconds per nautical mile round trip, every 12 microseconds of delay in the echo signal represents a nautical mile of range out there. So the timing of what comes back tells you how far out is the target. The strength of what comes back tells you how big is the reflectivity of the target. And if you've got the right kind of a so-called Doppler sensing radar, Well, in other words, the radar knows the exact frequency. Let me drop. The radar knows the exact frequency it sent out. Therefore, whatever comes back, if the target was not moving in any way, what comes back would be the exact same frequency. If the target is moving toward you, you get positive Doppler shift, and the signal is going to come back at a higher frequency. If the target is moving away from you, you're going to get a negative Doppler shift, and the signal coming back will be slightly lower in frequency. So the right kind of a Doppler sensing radar receiver, particularly an airborne Doppler radar, very carefully looks, you could say at around 50 hertz at a time, it looks at the slight difference in frequency of what comes back and converts that into miles per hour of slant range velocity. The one place where this fools you is that if the airplane is flying in a circle around the radar, and therefore all the airplane's velocity is at right angles to the radar, there you get a Doppler shift of zero, and at first you would think the airplane had no velocity. However, as that airplane paints onto that radar screen, a PPI it's called, planned position indicator, each 12 seconds the airplane's going to be moving a little bit, so you're going to get a series of dots on the screen, and those series of dots are going to follow a circle. So by looking at the past performance dots on the screen, even if the airplane is flying at right angles, you'll eventually figure out its velocity and its new location and what direction it's going. There are other kinds of radars where there's a so-called height finder function going on. In other words, not only is the antenna rotating in azimuth, but it is bobbing up and down in elevation. And depending on where it is in elevation and how strong the echo it is, it can figure out what is the height in miles or feet above the ground for that particular target. That's a height finder radar. The word radar is an extremely ubiquitous word. Let me drop. If you open up the book called Introduction to Radar by Skolnick, or if you open up his really big book called Radar, again by Skolnick, Engineering of Radar or something like that, I can't think of the exact title, the big red book, which is broken up into about 30 chapters, you could easily say there's 30 kinds of radar and beyond. Some of them have great big phased arrays where nothing moves mechanically, but the beam is steered electronically. Some of them have transmitters which put out fancy modulation during the pulse. And some of them sweep the frequency during the pulse. That's called a pulse compression radar. So there's lots and lots of kinds of radar. Just like there were 450 recognized brands of Protestant Christianity recognized in the United States, you could say there's at least 30 kinds of radar, probably a bigger number than that. So it's a very ubiquitous word. Each one has designed for very specific characteristics of velocity, angle, velocity change rate, angle change rate, polarization characteristics, reflectivity, spectral signatures, and so on. When you look at the echo coming from a particular fighter airplane, and some of the echo is coming from the turbine that's on the front end of that engine, which gives a particular kind of modulation to the signal, a smart radar operator with the right kind of receiver processor will say, I recognize that. That's the turbine whine of an F-15 airplane. So most likely that's an F-15 or an F-15-like airplane that I'm seeing the echo from. So there's all kinds of information you can get out of that. Maybe this helps a little bit. Over to you, Joe, for further description of what you'd like to know. Big subject, radar. And by the way, there's radar transmitters and there's radar jammers. So the jammers are called the countermeasures people, and then the people who redesign the radar to counteract the jamming.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's called countermeasures. And after that, the designer of the jammer does another kind of adaption to that, which is called countermeasures and so on. This goes on and on and on. And right now, the people who design the radars are winning the game because they've got huge amounts of adaptability. They can make each individual radar pulse come out at a different angle from the antenna because it's being electronically steered, a different frequency coming out of the transmitter, a different kind of modulation, a different kind of polarity. So you've got such agile capability of the way the radar transmitter works just when it's doing its transmitting. And there's a fancy kind of technique, for instance, called lobe on receive only, where the antenna is scanning in azimuth and elevation, but only on receive, and it doesn't do that on transmit. So So you sit out there with your airplane, you listen to the signals coming from that radar, and you don't even know that he is scanning you to find out what is your azimuth and elevation, because you don't see any of the scanning function, because he's only doing it on the receive. It's just one of a thousand things that are really crafty that radars can do that are not quite obvious at first. W2RYY, K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
K2KY, what a question.
Okay, Mel, Mel's question first. Go right ahead, Mel.
Just curious, it was very viable, I could say the early days of radar, World War II, where they were able to identify the actual, what kind of object it was by the intensity, the brightness on the display on the phosphorus of the screen. Is that still a measurement situation, Dick, or is that gone with the wind over?
Okay, a good instrumentation radar measures the magnitude of the echo. Usually it's in units of, what are the units now? Square meters. Sigma is the signal is used, is a symbol used for it. In other words, the strength of the echo in microwave square meters tells you something about the size of the aircraft, and that is a helping function, yes. But there's a hell of a lot more things you can do beyond that. One of the funny things that happened during World War II is that one of the best-kept secrets is that some of our bombers that were eventually flying over Germany were using radar to find the targets in the dark, through the clouds. And so we, the United States, didn't want it to be known that we had these radar installations that had this kind of visibility against it. So therefore, they let out a philosophy, a rumor, that these pilots were all being fed large amounts of carrots, and the vitamin A in the carrots were giving the pilots extremely good night vision, and therefore at nighttime they could see the targets and therefore do this precision bombing. And so to this day, there's a whole lot of people who believe you're doing tremendous improvement of your vision if you eat carrots. It turns out to be essentially untrue, but that started in World War II. But when it comes to identifying a target, nowadays there are kinds of radars that I've been exposed to which literally give you the equivalent of a photograph of the target. In other words, it creates an image of the target on an XY spot, on a plot, so to speak. And therefore, a smart person will say, I recognize that as a 707 airplane, an F-15, an F-18, whatever, F-111. So there are kinds of radars that can give you an image. Very expensive, not very many of them ever been deployed. But as you can tell, the word radar...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The word radar has so many different meanings and so many different embodiments. So just looking at the radar, the echo amplitude, when you've only got a small number of potential aircraft, I think that would work. But modern-day aircraft, there's so many kinds of them, you need a lot more information. So the way the target modulates the radar signal, and then these imaging radars can really allow you to tell a lot more about what's going on. We've only just barely scratched the surface on this one, Joe, but it's a big subject. W2RYY, K2RYW.
E7 phosphorus is then gone?
The long persistence phosphor is a huge disadvantage. Nowadays, you've got the equivalent of electronic phosphor. In other words, you record all of the signals you receive, and now you can set the electronics to act like a long persistence, a short persistence, or whatever phosphor if you like. So that's all done electronically these days. In fact, the majority of the modern-day radars don't even use a cathode ray tube anymore. They're using solid-state displays, not too different from the modern-day television set. Over to you, Joe.
Fascinating. And from what you said so far, this leads me to ask another question, if I may, within the same subject. How does a weapon system radar know how to track the target then? If you're telling me that if with Doppler shift it can tell if it's moving towards you or away from you, if the target suddenly changed direction and is moving at a right angle or left angle, so to speak, from the way the missile is going, for example, how would the thing know which way to go?
Another real big subject, Joe. There are gun-controlled radars, radar-controlled guns, on ships, for instance, where the rate of bullets being shot at the target, you could say, and immediately correcting. So a radar-controlled gun on a ship shooting at an airplane can have extreme accuracy, better than a human being ever had. When it comes to ground-launched missiles, for instance, that are you want them to intercept a particular target, there's a zillion ways a radar can do that. Some of them, you have a so-called acquisition radar, you've got a tracking radar. The tracking radar, in many cases, has a very broad beam coming out of the transmitter on the ground. It's sending out you could call it a big flashlight beam in the sky. The echo coming off the airplane is being sensed by the front end of the missile. There's a set of antennas, usually four antennas, on a tracking gimbal system where the seeker head on the front end of the missile looks at the echo coming off the airplane being painted by the broad beam antenna on the ground, and the missile then goes in the direction of where it's seeing the echo in the sky, if you know what I mean. And there's various ways by which it knows how close it is to the target. There's various ways how close it is to the target and whether or not it should arm itself into what's called the terminal home mode. So lots and lots of ways that can be done. There are ways where the missile is being steered completely from the ground, where the radar on the ground is with high precision measuring the azimuth and elevation and range of the target, feeding that information up to the tail of the missile, and the missile is then being ordered which way to go and when to explode. There's other kinds where the missile is active, semi-active, passive, and so on. Lots and lots of ways of doing it. But anything you can do with a flashlight and human eyes, you could say, can be done with a radar system that you wanted to use to do guidance of a weapon system. Maybe that helps a little bit, Joe. Was there someone else who had a question? KQRIW? I thought I heard someone else. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, very good. Very fascinating subject. I just thought I'd, ask him because I've always been kind of curious, and you'll be the one who certainly have the answers to something like this. All right, very good, Dick. Thanks. I'll be listening for a bit.
Yeah, the next time you're in a good technical library, Joe, do seek out the book called Radar by Skolnick, Skolnick. This man from the, I think at the time he was working for the General Electric Company, who was making many of the very large radars. He has written the Bible on the subject, both the Introduction to Radar and the Radar Handbook, as it's called. And the Radar Handbook is broken up into about 35 chapters. So the various kinds of radars, the circuits, the schematic diagrams, the functional block diagrams, the theory of operation, the way you make anechoic material. A modern-day aircraft, you put RAM on it. RAM stands for radar absorbent material. So, and in some cases, you're putting around the nacelle of the engine something called a structural RAM, structural radar absorbing materials, things that are strong and hard and can survive rain erosion, and yet radar signals hitting this material primarily get absorbed, don't reflect back, and you can drastically decrease the range at which a radar system is able to detect the target. And if you're real smart as a designer, you may set up your airplane to be so stealthy that the radar that you consider a threat is not going to be able to find your aircraft unless you're within 1 mile, and you're starting off at 100 miles away, and for the first 99 miles when you're driving toward that target, he doesn't even know you're there. When he finally does start seeing the little bit of echo you're making, that's called the burn-through range. That's a term that's used with reference to jammers. When you're doing a certain amount of jamming and the radar can no longer see you, as you get closer and closer, because the echo is getting stronger at not 60 dB per half range, but 12 dB, because the radar signal goes out 60 dB per octave in range, the signal's getting weaker. Let me drop. The signal reflects off the target and then comes back with another 60 dB per octave, a fall off. So therefore, the actual amount of echo the radar gets, it falls off at 12 dB per octave of range. Half the distance, and the signal got the 12 dB stronger in echo power back to the radar. So it's obvious by the signal getting strong real fast as you start getting close, no matter how much your jamming power is, eventually the echo he's getting is stronger than the jamming that you're emitting on the airplane, and he starts seeing you. That's called the burn-through range. So if you're real good at making your airplane very stealthy, if you're real good at making your transmitter that's doing the jamming very strong, then you could create a burn-through range that's so small that by the time he finally sees you and knows where you are, you're already there and you're already delivering the weapon, whatever it happens to be. And so that's part of the game and the way it's played. The more sophisticated kind of jamming is what's called spoofing. In other words, you create a phony target by way of your sophisticated jamming on your airplane. You create on his screen a phony target, and the phony target, you steer the phony target so that it is going away from him. In reality, you're really going toward him. And when he finally figures out what's going on, it's game over. That's called spoofing. A very sophisticated kind of jamming. There's a zillion ways of doing that. There's ways you can use his own signal against him with various very fancy echo modulation techniques. So there's a zillion ways of doing it. Lots of articles can be read these days because an awful lot of these techniques are now in open literature, if you know what I mean, Joe. When you learn all of the sophistication that's going into radar, and let me drop for a second. I think I can safely say that when it comes to radio transmitters and receivers and antennas, maybe a lot more research and development has gone on with the subject of radar than any other subject. So even though the radar system itself was not designed to communicate voice, not designed to communicate data, you could say that the breakthroughs that have occurred because of radar are some of what's going on right now when it comes to the use of a cell phone or a two-way radio or whatever. So if you want to really understand wireless electronics and you study radar, it's an extremely lucrative place where a lot of knowledge can be gained, and the principles of operation and how Mother Nature really behaves, an awful lot of that can be found out by radar. So darn good subject. As I say, when you visit your good library, pick up a copy of Skolnick, borrow it if they'll let you do that, and start flipping through those pages, and you'll suddenly say, wow, you combine the ARRL antenna book, the ARRL amateur radio handbook, and Skolnick's radar handbook. You combine those three books, and you've got an awful lot of wireless knowledge. Go for it, Joe. Let us know what you find out. Ed, K2 Golf Juliet Echo. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Ed. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quick comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, anybody interested in that weapon, one of the weapons you described, very similar to the Phalanx, and you can see that in Fleet Week right here in New York on the west side of Manhattan. The ships come in up near the Intrepid. You can go on a missile cruiser. You may even be lucky enough to get into the CIC room. But you look at the Phalanx and talk to one of the gentlemen there, one of the officers, they will tell you exactly how it works and how fantastic that weapon is at 4,500 rounds a minute. Cannot believe, and it has the acquisition, handoff radar, all that information is there, and they will walk you through it, including mines, too. Very interesting, and anybody interested, that's where they would go, then go to a library and read about it.
It's called the Phalanx system.
Yeah, that's what he said. John, would I be correct in assuming that in your working days, you were one of the guys making sure that the power on the ship was getting to all these fancy systems, so that they all had full operation capability? Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Absolutely, Dick. Absolutely. Although they were loaded with dummy rounds, the 20-millimeter rounds, a beautiful system, and when you take a look at the size of the cartridge cases, you would not believe it. But a wonderful experience, and you see how wonderful our Navy, all of our servicemen, are prepared. They look a little too young to do the job. They do it.
Also, the, what is it called now? The Southwest Seaport? No, I've got the name wrong, but there's a place off Manhattan on the southeast side where I think a number of these ships are continuously docked, and some beautiful displays of some of this hardware is also visible there. Over to you, John, for some further information on that one, because I've got it garbled. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, there are some ships near the seaport, but if you want to see the modern ships, they're on the west piers near the Intrepid when they come in. You can. The seaport has, I think, the Ambrose ship is there. There's some old sailing vessels. Interesting to see, but if you want to see this modern equipment, that's where you want to go. Very impressive.
Great stuff. Okay, Ed, K2GJE, go right ahead with your question and or comment. And we got enough time for both if you want to, Ed. You got it.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2RIW. This is K2GJE. I'm coming in on the your Eastern Link tonight. For some reason, the 850 is very noisy. But you, on the input, the 250 is clear as a bell, so it just must be some atmospheric condition here tonight. Mel spoke about sources of some components for people coming into the hobby, and I think I have one that was not mentioned. All electronics, and their site is www.allelectronics.com. Let me drop. Okay, I also have a phone number if Mel wants it. The prices really seem cheap. I don't know what the shipping is. It's coming from California. I think the prices would make up the difference if someone has to build something. They have resistors, capacitors, transistors, small boxes. They have coax and diodes and a lot of stuff at really cheap prices. Let me drop. You're talking about radar. Reminds me of a radar story. Would you like to hear a story, over?
We sure would. And give us both the phone number and the story. You got it, Ed.
Okay, I'm giving us a single beep out on the Eastern Link. I guess that's okay. I'll give you the 800 phone number. Why spend money? It's 800-826-5432. 800-826-5432. It's www.allelectronics.com. And the site also leads you to some other sites for components. So you could get it via the internet or get it cataloged via landline. Let me drop. When I was in the service, I was stationed in Germany for the purpose to repair transmitters that were on 24/7. They were transmitting FSK. And they were high-power transmitters, and basically that's all I did at any hour of the day or night. And it was a very easy job, especially for someone as a ham. But one time, at some small airport nearby, they lost their clutter. And you could tell them what clutter is. And they sent me out to find out what the problem was. And it was one of these typical like 2.5 mounted shelters, and the operator was on the inside and all the tubes were on the outside. Well, let me tell you, I knew nothing about this piece of equipment, so I asked the young lady if she had a schematic, and she handed me a book about 2 inches thick, all full of schematics. And the tubes were labeled 100 series, 200 series, and so on. I think up, going up to about 1,000 series. Well, lucky enough, in looking through one of the schematics, I found a tube called a clutter amplifier. How about that, over?
Wow. And I guess you were able to effect a repair. To a radar operator, you would like to see nothing on the target, on the cathode ray tube or on the display, the PPI, but his targets, the individual aircraft and maybe buildings nearby or whatever that he would recognize. And because of the way the radar works, targets become extremely strong in echo power to the radar when the target is in close. Therefore, just the ground that's around the radar for the first couple of miles, even though it's nice flat earth in some cases, gives them huge echoes, and that's called clutter. Anything that appears on the screen that you don't want, they call it clutter. And there are various ways of getting rid of clutter. An airspeed indicator type, in other words, a Doppler sensing radar it only displays the targets that have a Doppler shift, and all targets that don't have a Doppler shift get suppressed. That's one kind of display. of a radar technique, which will eliminate the ground clutter, the undesired echoes. But there's a catch, and that is if the airplane is flying at a very specific set of velocities, in other words, what's really going on with the Doppler sensing on most radars is that it expects there to be a certain number of degrees of phase shift of the echo signal from one pulse to the next, because the airplane is moving, and therefore the path length of the airplane is changing. Therefore, the phase of the echo you get is changing. But as you can tell, if the airplane is moving fast enough so that the echo between two consecutive pulses moves by 360 degrees or a multiple of 360 degrees, the echo sensing, the Doppler sensing radar, doesn't give...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In that case, the Doppler sensing radar would not give you the echo. Those are called blind speeds. So depending on the design of the radar, when you're in the Doppler sensing mode, you have specific velocities of range, of slant range rate, which are blind speeds. And therefore, a smart target might intentionally fly at one of those known blind speeds so that you don't see him on the screen. Therefore, you'd like to periodically flip over to the non-Doppler display to make sure you're not missing targets. So clutter and methods of eliminating clutter, there's lots of ways of doing it, but you pay the price. So, you know, every drug has a side effect. Well, every kind of fancy chunk of electronics you add to the radar gives you a certain benefit and in many cases a certain detriment, in which case a good radar operator has got lots of knobs and switches he can flip to go to the various modes to make sure he's not missing things. Thank you for any further comments, Ed. So, did you find out the clutter sensing circuitry and that particular tube is the one that needed replacement? K2GJE, out east. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, the military manuals label everything, and there was these doors, and you open them up, and behind them were nothing but tubes. And it wasn't even that difficult to find, because that tube was cold, and she had the tubes. But she insisted she had to have her clutter. I don't really know why. She was landing planes. There was fog. Matter of fact, the fog was so thick it was like pea soup. She was bringing in planes, and she insisted she had to have her clutter. And I heard her talk them down, and believe me, they must have had a lot of faith in her, because she was telling them if they were right or left of the field, at what altitude they were, etc. I assume they knew what altitude they were at, but I guess it had to be in reference to where they were going to touch down. But it was a very interesting experience, over.
It is many interpretations of what you just told me, Joe. The first interpretation is a so-called clutter coherent radar. One of the radars I worked on was called the AN/PPS5, PIPS5 we called it. This was a man-pack radar, 36 pounds, that a man could easily transport it, set it up as a tripod. This was intended for Vietnam service. It was one of the best-selling radars that Airborne Instruments Laboratory ever built. Lots and lots of them were sent to Vietnam. You set this radar up on the top of a molehill that's alongside of your tent, and you run the cable from the radar down into the tent, and anything out there that moves shows up on that radar. In other words, even though you've got dense jungle in front of you, if there's a man 3 miles away walking toward you, that radar will find him, and by the way it senses that moving target, you can now find out how far away, how fast he's moving, where he is he a friendly or a non-friendly, and some of the radar, when it would display it on the screen, the moving target, and it was a so-called clutter coherent radar, meaning, let me drop. The design of the radar was such that it knew it was going to be getting echo from the ground and the trees and everything else that's around. The echo from the man was a device that was moving differently than the trees. And as such, when the radar compared the phase angle of the clutter, the ground echo and the tree echo, compared to the echo at a particular range gate where the man was located, and the phase angle between the two was continuously changing, you knew that that was a moving target, and by way of the Doppler shift being positive or negative, you knew, is he moving toward you or away from you? And then you put on the earphones and you listen to that particular echo of that particular target. And I hear tell that a skilled operator could easily tell the difference between a tracked vehicle and a wheeled vehicle. And they even claim that with a lot of skill, they could tell the difference between a male walking toward you or a female walking toward you, because different portions of their body moved in different ways. I think there's a little bit of an extra brag on that one, but it was part of the advertising claim of Airborne Incidents Laboratory on that particular radar. And I've spoken to some of those trained radar operators who said, yes, it was true that under certain circumstances, they could definitely tell the difference between a male or a female by the way different portions of their body moved as they walked. Over to you for any further comments at K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay. We've only had two sign-ins so far. That was Joe and Ed. Anyone else with any quick questions before we go over to Miles' mailbag? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2YO.
Go right ahead, Bernie.
Pod and just had a set of earphones, and you would hear people crawling through the brush or vehicles moving. Is that what you're talking about? Over.
Yes, I am, Ed. Stand by a second there, Bernie. When you use this PIPS 5 radar in one of its modes, where it gave you an acoustic output at that particular range gate, and you put on this very fancy set of earphones, and you listen to the particular sound of the Doppler signal coming back from that particular target, you could easily tell by the difference in the sound whether or not it was a car, a truck, a tracked vehicle, a man walking, or in some cases a female walking. So the nature of the sound, the various portions of the body, I mean, a person walking, I've listened on the echo in that particular radar. When a person walks and their arms are swinging back and forth, the right-hand arm may be moving backward while the left-hand arm is moving forward. So you're getting simultaneous positive and negative Doppler shifts from just the arms, and the feet are moving in a particular way, and the torso is moving a different way. There's a very characteristic sound you get from a man walking at 3 miles in front of that radar. And is that your question, Ed? K2GJE, K2RIW?
Yes, it is. I did hear the audio on that radar only once when I was in the service. Someone was using it, and they gave me the earphones, and they told me that's a tractor plow. And it sounded something like a machine moving, but they seem to have known it was a tractor plowing the field. I have just one other thing. I think on last week's net, people, or you were speaking about protecting some of these very expensive tubes. I'm glad I didn't build amplifiers with them. There's a very good circuit in the ARRL book, RF Amplifier Classics, that uses an SCR to turn off the screen current. Over.
Yeah, to protect a tube and turning off the screen current is great if the tube happens to be a tetrode. But some of the very popular tubes that are used in grounded grid high power amplifier service for ham radio are triode tubes. And I found an article I was reading last night in one of the earlier issues of QST. I'll go get that issue later on and tell you it if you want to read it, where when it comes to protecting the tube, measuring control grid current is one of the first levels of protection. Another level of protection is to protect the tube from overdrive and or parasitic oscillations. And it's kind of hard to believe that a parasitic oscillation with the right kind of little gadget you add to the transmitter can easily eliminate the parasitic oscillation. But if you don't eliminate the parasitic oscillation, it does internal damage to the tube that is not sensed by sensing grid current or plate current per se. The control grid has got gold plating on it. You don't want to burn up the gold plating. You don't want any of that gold plating to be vaporized and fall onto the cathode and contaminate the cathode. So eliminating parasitic oscillations, eliminating the grief that the tube, these $800 tubes could experience if you overdrive them. I mean, that last dB of power output where you use overdrive on the tube, the manufacturer, let me drop it. In some cases, the manufacturer tells you very distinctly, the tube manufacturer is telling you, do not exceed 75 watts of drive in grounded good service on 20 meters with this particular amplifier. And the average guy is using a 100-watt capable amplifier, and he realizes that when he goes from 75 watts of drive to 100 watts of drive, he gets more power output. He says, why shouldn't I do that? I've done it for the last 10 minutes. The amplifier didn't burn up. Why can't I keep doing it? Well, you read that article, you find out that there's a significant shortening of the life of the tube you could be experiencing when you do that, and you might be damaging the tube because of this gold vaporization technique that takes place internally. And you might also want to double-check that your particular circuit has these parasitic oscillator killing networks to make sure that the amplifier, while you're amplifying a signal at 14 megacycles, if the tube is simultaneously oscillating at 112 megs internally, and even if that signal is not getting out the back panel of the amplifier, the fact that the oscillation is taking place within the tube is potentially damaging. And you would like to sense that if you're a real careful guy, and you'd like your tubes, your expensive tube, to last a long time. It's something to be aware of. So maybe downrange, I'll tell you which article that was in, and you can go to the ARL archives and read it. Very well done article on protecting these expensive tubes. Bernie, K2 Yankee Yasser, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick in the net. My question is regarding cable testing. I've been making a lot of RF cables lately, and I got to thinking about what's the best way I can that I can test these. I'm in the computer business, and for like network cabling, we all carry TDR based cable testers that'll basically say, okay, this cable you just put connectors on is good to a gigabit or in excess of a gigabit, etc. But those are $700-$800 testers, and I don't particularly want to invest that kind of money into just my ham radio cable testing. But beyond basic connectivity, right now I check to make sure I've got connectivity. I check to make sure that I've got an open between the braid and the center conductor. What else can I do to test cables as I'm making them? These are generally short, 5 or 6 foot length jumper kind of cable stuff. What would you recommend?
There's a lot of different answers to your question, Bernie. I'll give you a couple of hints. If I'm building a piece of coax cable with a BNC connector on the end, a piece of RG58 cable, or UHF connectors or UG21 connectors, and it's a piece of RG8 cable instead of RG58, and I do a good ohmmeter test and a good visual inspection, the braid is well combed out. Let me drop it. The braid is well combed out. The collet mechanism is well established. The nut is tightened down correctly. I twist the connector on the end of the cable, and I can tell it's mechanically secure. My ohmmeter says there's no short between center conductor and outer. My ohmmeter says the center conductor and the shield both have proper conductivity. You've now confirmed that cable, and you don't have to do any more elaborate testing. Between 0 and 30 megs, it'll be extremely difficult for that particular jumper cable to have a fault that very simple set of tests I just indicated wouldn't indicate to you. But now, if you're about to use that cable as a jumper between your driver and your transmitter on 432 or 1296, that's a different animal. Particularly now, if it was a foam-filled cable and you worry about whether or not somebody has squeezed it at one time and the semiconductor and the shield is almost touching each other and there's a bump in the impedance, which wouldn't affect 14 megacycles, but it might really affect 1296 because that bump happens to be a quarter wavelength long, if you know what I mean. And when it comes to higher and higher frequency characteristics and good performance of a cable, you're now looking into the fine details of any impedance perturbation along the length of the cable. And now you really would like to do a network analyzer test if you could get a hold of one. A network analyzer with the right kind of a dummy load on the end of it, and you measure the input reflection coefficient, the S11. That gives you a lot of specific data as to a real good cable. All reflection from the cable with a good dummy load at the far end is going to be 25 dB down. A bad cable is going to be 6 dB down. And by way of the network analyzer in the Steinhelfer mode telling you that the fault in the cable is 3 feet and 6 inches downrange from the input connector, that's very valuable information. Now, there is an article in QST that I ran into, again, yesterday, looking at this
repeater, timeout. Repeater.
use a simple standing wave ratio bridge and a transmitter, sweeping the transmitter, using the standing wave ratio bridge, using various loads on the end. In this particular case, they were picking up unknown pieces of cable by putting various loads on the end of the cable and sweeping the input connector on the cable. You can easily find out what is the characteristic impedance of the cable, because it might be a strange cable with a number on it. It's got a mil spec something to it, and you don't recognize it as one of the popular numbers like RG8, RG214, and so on. So there are techniques by way of anything that can measure directional characteristics, a directional coupler, a Berg wattmeter, a standing wave ratio bridge, and your transmitter. Because you're using that particular cable in the shack on your particular transmitter, and because you usually have something like a Berg wattmeter where you've got a slug that covers that particular frequency range, and as long as you've got a dummy load that can take enough power to be above the threshold of the low end of sensitivity of your particular slug for your Berg wattmeter at that particular frequency range, that's another very good way of confirming the performance of the cable. Or if you know you've got a good antenna and you put that piece of cable as a jumper with a male-to-male or a female-to-female adapter, putting that cable in series with the rest of your transmission line. Let me drop. And now you measure your antenna barefoot, and then you measure your antenna with this extra piece of cable in there, and you're measuring what you see on your Berg wattmeter. That's a very strong indication of the quality of that cable. And while you're at it, if you've got a high enough power transmitter, hit it with full power and make sure nothing gets hot. Usually the faults that you get at a connector, because improper connection, will show up as extra heat as well as reflected signal. So it's pretty difficult for a cable to really be bad when a guy with a sharp set of eyes and the skill of installing a UG21 type N connector does a good job. As long as the cable doesn't look like it's dripping water, as long as it's not foam-filled cable that's been sitting in the basement in the high dampness area and sucking up water for a whole lot of years, a good visual inspection and a good mechanical inspection by trying to twist the connector is really going to catch 95% of the faults that you care about, as I see it, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm at Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if you remember in the old days before the TDRs, we used to just use a basic oscilloscope and a pulse generator and terminate the line and send the pulse down the line, and look at the reflection. You can pick up almost any fault in that cable. Basically, pretty easy to do and not expensive.
When you were looking at the echoes on the cable, John, were you doing it with a directional coupler? That would be the sophisticated technique. Or were you using nothing but a simple T connector into the oscilloscope? And was it a sampling oscilloscope that worked at the RF frequency? Over to you, John.
It was a simple T connector, and we could use either scope. It worked with the old 455 Tektronix. We used to do it all the time. And it really, when we found the old cable, we just wanted to check it out before we'd use it. We would do that preliminary test, and never failed me.
Okay, so I've got a fast oscilloscope, good for a couple of hundred megacycles, on a T-connector going into the cable. The cable hopefully is properly terminated by a known good antenna or a known good dummy load. And now you've got a pulse generator, is what you said. What frequency, what pulse duration? Was it a square wave generator? Was it a RF pulse generator? What was the nature of the signal generator you were using, John? And what was the pulse rep rate and whatever? Give us a little more information as to how you set up the pulse generator to do that test. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, we would take the pulse from that was driven at the output of the oscilloscope that has a pulse tap on that, right on the front panel, and we would feed that into the T-connector, and we would just send, basically even a 1 KC pulse will work. It's sharp enough, and it will do the job. You can tell the length of the cable if you know the velocity factor, and it's very easy, and it's a quick and dirty test, and it'll keep you out of trouble.
Okay, so just a square wave, 1 kilohertz or whatever it is, square wave. Oh, wait a minute now. In the case of Tektronix oscilloscopes, when you're using the calibration signal on the front panel, it is a square wave signal, and the square wave signal goes up in frequency when you set the scan rate faster. In other words, you can set the scan rate on your